This program contains explicit content and subject matter which may be unsuitable for some listeners. Discretion is advised.
Smart. Sexy. Kinky. Fun.
Welcome to Sex Out Loud with your host, sex educator, author, and filmmaker, Tristan Taramino. It's sex-positive radio like you've never heard before. Tristan talks about sexuality from every angle with leading authors, experts, artists, and icons. From sex education and sexual politics to BDSM and non-monogamy, nothing is off limits. So get ready to open your mind and expand your horizons. This is Sex Out Loud. And now here's your host, Tristan Taramino.
Welcome to Sex Out Loud, everyone. Hey, we're live today. So if you want to call and talk to me or my guest or join the conversation, if you have a question or a comment, you can call us at 866-472-5788. 866-472-5788. We also have a 24-hour voicemail line. So if you aren't listening live, but you have a question or a comment, you can call 323-SEX-8266. That's 323-SEX-8266. If you are a regular listener on the show, you know that we have discussed these insidious bathroom laws about who's allowed to go to the bathroom and where. And although North Carolina is the only state that has passed one of these laws, which discriminates against trans and non-binary people, there are lots of pending legislation items that have to do with this bathroom stuff. And that is just one of a whole host of topics covered by my guest in his brand new book. And when I say new, people, I'm like, it just shipped out. So I'm getting this. I got it before I think most people did. I'm just saying, maybe you pre-ordered it. I don't know. Let me tell you about him. Heath Fogg Davis is an associate professor of political science at Temple University, where he teaches courses on anti-discrimination law, political theory, and public policy. Davis also consults with businesses, schools, and organizations to help them imagine, develop, and implement trans-inclusive policies that are institutionally smart. He was recently appointed to the Mayor's Commission on LGBT Affairs in Philadelphia and has been an organizer of the Philadelphia Trans Health Conference. He's the author of the new book, Beyond Trans: Does Gender Matter? Out now from NYU Press. Welcome to Sex Out Loud, Heath.
Thank you so much, Tristan. I'm really delighted to be here.
So, does gender matter is not a rhetorical question.
No.
Actually explore that throughout the book. Although it's good, you know, it's a very provocative question. So I think it's good for sales also. But you do explore it throughout the book. The book opens with a story about Charlene Arcilla, an African-American transgender woman in Philadelphia. And I'm hoping you might share that story so we can sort of set the stage.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. So Charlene, and just incidentally, she was the founder of the Philadelphia Trans Health Conference, which happens every year. So Charlene Arcilla, who's no longer with us, unfortunately, she died 2 years ago. But she had been a longtime activist in Philadelphia around issues not just affecting trans people, but also people living with HIV and AIDS. In any event, as you mentioned, African American transgender woman who was also somebody who used public transportation to get around Philadelphia. Philadelphia had this very bizarre policy, which was that each monthly bus pass that you purchased had to have either a sex sticker, basically, so either an M for male or an F for female, a very strange policy. So it caused all sorts of problems for all sorts of people. I'm sure we'll get into that, but just getting back to Charlene's individual story, She had, and this was a common occurrence for her, she presented her female marked pass to a bus operator and was rejected on the basis of that particular person said, "You're not, in my opinion, a real woman." And so she was turned away, couldn't use her bus pass. Subsequently tried to use an M for male marked pass to board a bus and was also turned away, told that she's not male. So it put her in this no-win situation. She filed a legal complaint with the city of Philadelphia. In Philly, like a lot of cities around the country, we have gender identity and gender expression as a protected category. So she brought a legal complaint against the public transportation company, and it dragged its heels for a long time, but eventually got rid of the stickers. And I tell the story, for a couple of reasons. I mean, it really goes to this question about, the relevance of a sex marker. And in this particular case, it's so clear that this was ridiculous and it had nothing to do with our, civil right of riding a public bus. So I think, and Charlene, there's, she talked very poignantly about her experiences, and it really adds a human dimension about the kind of humiliation that this caused for her and for a lot of other and transgender appearing people. So I really try to emphasize that in the book, that this is really about how we're perceived, so that like gender conforming trans people such as myself often can escape that kind of discrimination, but it also goes to anybody who appears to be not quite what that individual, person thinks a woman or a man should look like.
And you ask these salient questions, which are like, is it important that we know a person's gender in order to give them identification and verify their ID, right? So in order to give them a bus pass, do we really need to know their gender? In order to see if someone is old enough to buy alcohol, do we need to know their gender? Or if they're allowed to vote, do we need to know their gender? Which I think are really good questions. And you lay it out in such a rational argument, because it's sort of like, why is this relevant? And yet at every form you fill out, and I feel like I don't know how many forms the average person fills out, but it feels like, at least five a week. Mm-hmm. It's practically the first question that they ask you.
Yep.
And it doesn't matter where you are. Like, you could be at the doctor, or you could be wanting to become a member of a museum, for example. Right?
Yeah, and exactly. I have a daughter who we just signed up for, daycare, and right after her name, they wanted to know her sex, and it's like you said. I mean, it's such a kind of like a rote kind of social custom that it's almost like whenever you make up any kind of form that you have to ask people to check a box. When you really think about it, with the bus pass example, what's the legitimate policy goal there? The bus company defended itself, and this policy was on the books from 1981 all the way up to 2013. Defended its policy on the basis of preventing fraud. And it had also a very kind of very heterosexist kind of assumption built into it, because they made the claim that in a household, like a husband and a wife would pass the bus pass back and forth, and they had a legitimate reason for wanting to prevent this. So that falls apart on on so many different levels. Businesses do have a legitimate interest in preventing fraud, but sex markers were not in any way kind of rationally related to that objective.
Plus, this example of the bus driver is only one of many that you give throughout the book of this so-called enforcement of policies and the fact that it falls into the hands of, everyday people. Like bus drivers, like bouncers at a bar. And then they have to both interpret the policy of the business and make their own judgment call, which is essentially based on their visual assessment of someone. Mm-hmm. And of course, their biases come into play.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And it was interesting for me when I looked into it to even see the employee handbook for the bus company in Philadelphia. So bus operators were just instructed to, number one, check for the correct date on the pass, and then secondly, to check for the correct gender marker. And you talk about a quick visual assessment. You can imagine, like, the buses in Philly are, you know, especially during certain times of the day, incredibly crowded, and bus operators are just, you know, barely looking at these passes. But what they are aware of and what they're authorized to do is to, if they want to enforce the policy, that gender marker policy, then they were authorized to do so. And so, like, just getting back to your point about the subjectivity and it falling on that individual to both interpret the policy, because of course the handbook, the employee handbook, did not specify how to conduct a gender inspection of somebody trying to board the bus. So, you know, and just kind of connected to that point, I point out in the book that the vast majority of Philadelphia bus operators did not enforce this policy in a discriminatory way. And I think that's important to point out, you know, but some did. And it's that discretionary authority that I really, really pinpoint as deeply problematic, because it creates an environment where somebody like Charlene or anybody who was gender nonconforming in any kind of way has to wonder every time they board a bus, is this going to be the time when I get hassled and you know, the person gives me a hard time and doesn't let me use my pass?
And also, there's such a fucked up class component to all this, obviously, you know, that intersects with race here too, about who sort of doesn't get to use the bus and who gets sort of called out for being, you know, because I feel like there's supposed to be a specific adherence to, like, what we consider traditional femininity and traditional masculinity. And those are always defined as white, even though no one says they are. Yeah. And then what about this whole notion of fraud? Like, what?
Yeah.
Like, we're talking about a bus ride, are we not?
Exactly. Right.
Like, it's as if this person now has access to, like, I don't know, Swiss bank accounts or something.
It seems
as ridiculous as the bathroom situation to me.
Absolutely. The stakes are incredibly low there. You're absolutely right about the race, sex, class dimension, the sort of like the whole intersectionality of the scenario. The class dimension is there insofar as, you know, people who are dependent on public transportation in Philadelphia, for the most part, are people who can't afford to have their own private vehicles, you know. And I talk about my own relationship to her story because I had worked with Charlene in a lot of, like, you know, different trans activist things in the city. But there's a huge class divide between us. And I was also somebody who took the bus up to Temple University where I teach. But I didn't have to take it every day, and I could, like, get a zip car and do different things, you know. So I didn't actually have to buy the monthly pass, and it was only the monthly pass where the sex stickers were on. So it was really just singling out on a class basis. And then, as you point out, the racial component, whenever somebody is conducting some kind of, you know, gender inspection, visual inspection, of course, they're also seeing race. You know, we can't not do that, especially in this country, and make all sorts of assumptions. So all of that is going on at the same time. And then you start to think, like, do we really want to, like, number one, like, authorize people to make these judgments, but also to saddle them with the responsibility? Like, why, as a bus operator, should I even have to get into this territory?
Mm-hmm. And are you even paid enough to? The answer is no.
Exactly. Yeah. You know the answer to that one, yeah.
So we're going to take a break and hear from our fantastic sponsors, including the Pleasure Chest. I'm going to tell you all about what's coming up at the Pleasure Chest this week. There's actually a lot going on more than average. Maybe it's just because it's summer. And also B-Vibe. I have told you this before, people, and I'll say it again. B-Vibe makes some of the best butt toys on the market. And their marketing is super anal positive and very inclusive. They're the first company to tackle anal as something that anyone does, regardless of gender, body, sexual orientation. And I love them for that. You can check them out at bvibe.com. Stay with us. More with Heath Fogg Davis when we return.
Pride is a time of both celebration and resistance, a time to reflect on how far we've come and how far we still have to go. The Pleasure Chest was birthed in the West Village during the Stonewall era and has spent the past 45 years asserting sexual fulfillment is a fundamental right and creating a space where everyone is welcome and accepted. In honor of Pride Month, Pleasure Chest will be presenting a full lineup of queer-themed workshops and events that are free to the public, including special guest educators like Damon Holtzum, Dr. Liz Powell, and me. You can also visit pleasurechest.com for curated collections of sex toys, such as M for M, Queer Couples, and Strap On, Get Off. Pick up something for a loved one or a little something sexy for yourself. And remember, you get a free massage candle when you use the code Tristan at checkout. B-Vibe is a premium collection of anal sex toys. Their products feature different sizes to accommodate users of all shapes, sizes, and experience levels. B-Vibe's high-end designs are couples-friendly, body-safe, and offer innovation aimed to create an exceptional user experience. You know I've got really high standards when it comes to anal toys, and I am in love with these. Plus, they stand behind each item with an easy-to-understand, hassle-free warranty. Dubbed as the Apple of anal, learn how B-Vibe and its premium anal plugs are engaging couples to discover the amazing pleasures of anal play. Visit bvibe.com and use coupon code Tristan to receive 20% off your purchase.
You're tuned in to Sex Out Loud with your host, Tristan Taramino. We want to hear from you. If you have a question or comment, please send an email to Tristan at puckerup.com. That's Tristan at puckerup.com. Now back to the show.
Welcome back to Sex Out Loud, everyone. I am talking today with Heath Fogg Davis about his new book out from NYU Press called Beyond Trans: Does Gender Matter? And I thought we would give you a little taste of it by having him read a little section. So whenever you are ready, Heath.
Okay, great. Great. So I'll read a little bit from the book then. So I say, I believe that all of us would be better off in a society with dramatically fewer sex classification policies. And I argue that the basic structure of anti-discrimination law can help make this happen. But the kind of legalism that I have in mind is not adversarial. Lawsuits and the threat of lawsuits are sometimes needed in order to force people and organizations to do what they otherwise are unwilling to do. But I also believe that anti-discrimination laws can be used to inspire and bring about positive institutional change before conflict arises and the lawyers are called in. In a series of four case studies, I show why it is in the best interest of organizations of all kinds to minimize their administration of sex. When sex classification is relevant, and it sometimes is, it is also in their best interest to redesign such policies so that the harm of sex identity discrimination is minimized. I suggest that organizations apply a literal and pragmatic interpretation of the diagnostic rational relationship test at the center of judicial review to their administrative policies regarding sex. The legal test asks whether a given policy is rationally related to a legitimate policy goal. In layperson's terms, this means asking whether a given sex classification policy is harmful and whether it is necessary. More often than not, I find that there are better, more efficient ways for an organization to to meet its policy goals than invoking sex education. When sex is relevant to a legitimate policy goal, it behooves an organization to clearly articulate this relevance and make it transparent, both to itself and to the public. Why is a sex classification policy that was once on the books or customary now being eliminated? Why is a specific sex classification policy being retained? Why is a revised or new sex classification policy being put into place?
Okay, and if you just, that was good. If you just joined us, everyone, Heath is using the term sex here as some people would use the term gender, but it's the marker. He's using it as the sort of marker that you were assigned at birth that sits on your ID, that you have to check on a box that you get segregated into. So we're using sex and gender as similar here. So not sex in the usual way that we talk about sex on the show. I just want to clarify that. Mm-hmm. Okay. So this is a really good, that's a really good introduction, I think, for people to see what your sort of central argument is. And I think one of the things that echoes throughout the book is this notion that current trans activism has sort of sought to seek what you call accommodation or assimilation. Mm-hmm. And you think that's the wrong direction to go. Tell me about that.
I do.
I mean, and explain what it means. It's like, give
sure.
us.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So by assimilation, I mean this idea of, that the goal should be to have trans people assimilate into either the female sex category or the male sex category. And if you look at a lot of sort of the civil rights activism, and mainstream trans activism, that's been the main goal, to not try to get rid of the sex binary in these policies, but to keep the policies, the sex classification policies, but let people make a decision, self-determine where they belong in that binary. So that's the assimilation model. The accommodation model is also a kind of a mainstream approach. If you think about the bathroom scenario, it's when you have that third option. So maintaining the men and women's restrooms in a public building, but then, adding another purpose to a single user stall that was maybe designed for people who need it because of a disability. So that's the accommodation model. And if you think about the form example, that's when you keep the M and the F, and then you add, transgender, or you add a non-binary classification, which is, what's happening right now with DC and Oregon in terms of their driver's licenses, moving to that kind of model. The problem with both of those, I think, is that it's not radical enough. It doesn't it doesn't protect somebody like Charlene Arcilla, who was somebody who, based on how other people perceived her, had a hard time having her self-statement about her gender, her female sex identity, believed by people in the pop sphere. So, I mean, that's who's really vulnerable when it comes to transgender discrimination. It's not all transgender people. It's people who may identify as trans and may not identify as trans, but are, in appearance, don't conform to social expectations of what men and women should look like.
I know someone who transitioned on the job recently, and they gave him a single stall bathroom that was just a single stall bathroom, and they designated it and sent a press release out that said, "This is now an all gender bathroom." First of all, there's only one, and it's far away from where he works in the building.
Mm-hmm.
And people also like cisgender people like it because it gives them more privacy. So it's often full and unavailable.
Right.
So that's just a practical example of how, if you think you're creating this sort of separate but equal thing, you haven't actually addressed the problem, right?
Right.
Because there's still these men's rooms and women's rooms, and he doesn't feel comfortable right now going into either.
Yeah, yeah. I'm glad that you brought up that scenario. In my own work situation, I transitioned pretty late in life at age of 38, so I'm 46 now. And good intentions by my employer, but also, you know, said, okay, we'll designate a bathroom on the 10th floor of your building. We'll give you a key so you can access the department that you don't belong to, but you need to, you know, enter there to access it. My office is on the 4th floor, so the convenience thing, like, this just wasn't thought through about, like, every time that you need to use the bathroom, having to go up six floors, and then also, like, to be conspicuous about it. Like, I did it a few times, and then people were sort of like, why are you up here? So very, very strange. It makes me think of the movie Hidden Figures, where...
That scene came to my mind right away, yes.
Yeah, where, there we're talking about racial segregation, but when she's working in the office that was nothing but white men, they were wondering, where do you go every day? Like, you know, like, you leave and you're gone for a while and then we don't see you. And then finally, she's like, I'm going to the bathroom because there's no bathroom for me in this building. And I think it's so poignant in that movie, that example, because it goes to both the extreme inconvenience that this caused for this individual, but also the fact that the privilege of everybody who didn't have to think about that issue. They literally could not imagine where she went, you know, even though they knew that there were no, you know, colored bathrooms in the building that they were working in. So like, conservatives and people who make it out like the bathroom issue is a silly issue. Do we really need to talk about this? It's like, yes, we do, because it's a privilege not to have to think about it, you know? And it's a very kind of powerful way of excluding somebody from a workplace, a school, the public sphere in general. It's extremely effective because, as in that example, nobody wants to sort of, like, you know, we have a lot of, like, social constipation in this culture about talking about what we do in bathrooms in the first place, you know, so it's like you can't even mention, but that was part of what was going on for her as well in that scene.
Yeah, absolutely. And you also bring up this really fantastic point, which is when women demanded bathrooms, like, in the workplace, they were like, okay, so we've got this bathroom for men and there's, like, 2 urinals and 3 stalls. So we'll give the women a bathroom with 3 stalls. Okay, great. Mm-hmm. It's like, that's equal, right? That's equality right there. And it doesn't take into account that women take longer in the bathroom for a whole variety of reasons. And it sort of defaults to the way we built this around men going to the bathroom. We'll just, now we'll just stick the women's sign on it and it'll be fine. Rather than thinking through, like, what actually serves, what actually serves different populations, and what do different people need, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Like, it goes to our bodies and how we pee and all these things that we're not comfortable talking about. I'm glad that you brought up that example of gender parity, because the bathroom issue that we're dealing with right now, which has been labeled this, like, transgender issue, which I think we really need to unpack, and we kind of started to do this in our conversation here, but it's also about the fact that whenever you have sex segregated facilities, there you can almost never make them equal, you know. And so I had many years of using, you know, female designated bathrooms, so I had this experience, as many people have, of long lines, you know, waiting to access the women's bathroom, and then you see, like, the men's is completely, you know, people are just, like, zipping in and out. And as you point out, that has to do with the architecture, you know, it has to do with, like, the urinal and how bathrooms are constructed. There's no reason that inequality has to exist. In the 1990s, there were all these, like, potty parity lawsuits that women brought. And some of the solutions were to, okay, we'll add more toilet stalls. We'll try to make that equal to the number of urinals plus bathroom stalls in men's rooms and do it that way. But it was always, you're in a game where you can never, if you're talking about time to use the bathroom as the basis of the measure of equality, you can never guarantee that with two separate sex-segregated bathrooms.
And, you know, this happens to me all the time. I go to these Buddhist retreats, and they're like 80% women. Mm-hmm. In my experience, the ones I go to. And mm-hmm. when we take a break to go to the bathroom, there's a men's room and a women's room. And so there's no line at the men's room because there's so few men. Right. And so I try to get everyone, you know, to agree we're going to use both bathrooms. Everyone's going to use the bathroom. And I've had women say to me, but so you're going to go in the men's bathroom. And I'm like, right. And I'm going to use the stall because like that's how I pee. And and have people say to me, but then there might be men in there peeing at urinals.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I'm like, uh-huh. And
right.
I'm not really interested in, like, I just have to go, I just have to pee and we have to be back here in 15 minutes. Like, what is the panic of me seeing someone standing at a urinal?
Yeah, absolutely. And the other thing, too, that we haven't talked about as a culture is that not every man can use a urinal, and I'm not just talking about trans men like myself, but there are cisgendered men who can't use a urinal, don't want to use a urinal for a variety of reasons. Some of them, you know, maybe they have their pee shy, you know, they don't want other people to look at them. So this is like, it goes back to your earlier point that bathrooms in this country are constructed around a certain kind of male embodiment, you know, and it doesn't even serve the majority of men all that well. So we have so many different layers of like bullshit to really unpack about how we, and to me, it's an architectural solution. You know, you build, design and build bathrooms differently so that you give individual people, regardless of their anatomy and how they pee, a reasonable amount of privacy, you know, and you let them do that and we get on with it. And we have some examples in Philadelphia and in Manhattan where in some restaurants you'll have like just like a row of individual stalls, all gender neutral, and then in the middle, like sinks and a mirror where everybody can, you know, wash their hands or whatever. You don't need to have sex segregation, and nobody seems to even care in those scenarios. So the policy goal that's legitimate when you're constructing public bathrooms is that you do give people like a certain degree of privacy to allow them to use the bathroom, I think.
Right. Okay, we got to take another break. We've gone over in the bathroom department here,
okay.
even though I literally could talk about it for the entire episode. Okay, let's take another break, hear from our sponsors. When we come back, I am going to tell you about what was most challenging for me in this book, and it surprised even me. So we will get to another one of Heath's case studies and talk about if gender matters when we return.
Pride is a time of both celebration and resistance, a time to reflect on how far we've come and how far we still have to go. The Pleasure Chest was birthed in the West Village during the Stonewall era and has spent the past 45 years asserting sexual fulfillment is a fundamental right and creating a space where everyone is welcome and accepted. In honor of Pride Month, Pleasure Chest will be presenting a full lineup of queer-themed workshops and events that are free to the public, including special guest educators like Damon Holtzum, Dr. Liz Powell, and me. You can also visit pleasurechest.com for curated collections of sex toys, such as M for M, Queer Couples, and Strap On, Get Off. Pick up something for a loved one or a little something sexy for yourself. And remember, you get a free massage candle when you use the code Tristan at checkout. Bee Vibe is a premium collection of anal sex toys. Their products feature different sizes to accommodate users of all shapes, sizes, and experience levels. Bee Vibe's high-end designs are couples-friendly, body-safe, and offer innovation aimed to create an exceptional user experience. You know I've got really high standards when it comes to anal toys, and I am in love with these. Plus, they stand behind each item with an easy-to-understand, hassle-free warranty. Dubbed as the Apple of anal, learn how Bee Vibe and its premium anal plugs are engaging couples to discover the amazing pleasures of anal play. Visit BeeVibe.com and use coupon code Tristan to receive 20% off your purchase. Are you LGBTQIA? Genderqueer or gender variant, a sex worker, an activist, a polyamorous person? Well, the open list features therapists, sexuality and relationship coaches, traditional and alternative healthcare providers, mediators, lawyers, and more who are poly-aware, kink competent, sex positive, queer affirming, and anti-oppression. They work with clients with alternative sexualities and relationship structures, including open relationships, polyamory, ethical non-monogamy, swinging, BDSM, and kink. They serve the unique needs of folks who think and live outside the box. To search for a professional in your area, go to the open list at openingup.net. If you're a professional who'd like to be listed, use the coupon code OPENTRIAL for a free 1-year trial.
You're tuned in to Sex Out Loud with your host, Tristan Taramino. We want to hear from you. If you have a question or comment, please send an email to Tristan@puckerup.com. That's Tristan@puckerup.com. Now back to the show.
Welcome back to Sex Out Loud, everyone. I'm talking today with Heath Fogg Davis about his brand new book, Beyond Trans, Does Gender Matter? And probably it's not a surprise to you that as I read this, I was like, right, gender on birth certificates, driver's license, passports, we don't need it. Gendered bathrooms, who cares? Even gender in sports, I'm not for it. And then I got to this chapter and found myself surprisingly challenged by this particular thing that you argue we should also not segregate by gender. And that is college admissions and women's colleges. So I tried to sort of interrogate like what my issue was so that I could come to you with my issue rather than just be like, I have an issue. And I understand it in theory. Like I totally understand how problematic it is and how right now, except for some schools who have clarified their policies and who have specific language around it, there's a lot of sort of like moving around. Like, are we going to say you're female at birth? And if you were female at birth, regardless of what you are now, you can be at a women's college. Some people are using the women born language. That just reminds me of Michigan and gives me hives. people who self-identify as a woman, you were socialized as a woman, and all this could apply to various cis or trans people depending on their lives and their backstory and when they transition and all that stuff. So I'm on board with like all women going to women's colleges. But your argument takes it one step further and says, nope, we shouldn't even have women's colleges. So let's talk about that.
Yeah, let's talk about that. And just to make one small amendment to what you said in terms of characterizing my argument, I think that actually we should talk about like with private women's colleges, that's what we're talking about, in a similar way that we talk about historically black colleges and universities. So maybe historically women's colleges. I recognize and I'm in full support of the reason why those institutions exist, to promote female leadership and to there are all sorts of feminist goals and objectives that I really get behind and very supportive of. However, like you were saying, once you start to get into the administrative policies about like if you're going to be a women's college, then you have to define women. And that's, of course, where these institutions have found themselves really embroiled in this like set of really interesting questions. And you went over a lot of them. I talk about the example of Mount Holyoke, which I think is a great institution. That place has gone the farthest of any women's college and said that anybody except for the group of people that were designated as male at birth and identify as male at the time of the application. It seems to me, when you talk about that particular exclusion, that it starts to not even make sense to exclude that group, because you're sort of stereotyping that group. And I think that actually that group of people in our society could benefit a lot from being in a majority female environment that where leadership opportunities and the whole structure is based around promoting female achievement and leadership opportunities and all that. So I just think it's interesting to sort of, you know, to think that through. So my whole thing, I would love to retain, for women's colleges to retain their historical mission, but to drop the gender-based exclusion. But it's a tricky thing, I know.
Yeah, I mean, so my thought there is, you know, and for the most part, I like a lot of spaces to be all gender for the most part. And then when I found, and I went to a quote co-ed college, right? But I know a lot of people who went to women's colleges. And one thing that we can track and that we know is that women who go to women's colleges and people who go to women's colleges end up in positions of power and leadership at much higher rates than people who don't, right? Right. Maybe that's not the right way to say it. But like all these major power players in our mm-hmm. world have come from women's colleges. And we see the measure or the metric of success in mm-hmm. terms of positions of leadership and power and all that stuff, right? And mm-hmm. that's because there's this whole environment where there isn't this issue of people in the room who take up too much space and who have unchecked privilege and unchecked entitlement. And these, mm-hmm. of course, are dudes, primarily cis guys, primarily heterosexual, primarily white. Not mm-hmm. all of them, not all of you guys, okay? So don't send me your angry letters. But what I'm picturing here is like I'm picturing like a discussion in a classroom, and there's a few people who are a little bit shy, but they've like really gotten their feet under them because they've been at this all-women school. And then like up rolls white guy who is going to raise his hand, talk over the teacher, and do a bunch of other shit that's going to piss me off.
Right. Yeah.
And what do I do about that guy? Because I agree that I agree that that guy can be there. And it would be interesting to see what men might go to a historically women's college, what that would look like. Right. And why mm-hmm. they might. But I feel like if I went to a historically black college, I would go there with the intent of literally shutting the fuck up and stepping back and taking up as little space as possible, because that is not my space.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I just don't have faith that these guys are going to do that.
Yeah. And I know exactly what you're talking about, because I've seen that happen in classrooms as both as a student and prior to transitioning to male. So I had that experience, and also being on the teacher end of things and seeing classroom dynamics. So I totally get what you're saying. And there's a little bit of a question mark. I mean, I think that like for me also about what kind of dude would apply to a women's college, and what happens, I guess there's also a concern about sort of like a tipping point also. Like I could see a benefit from those individuals being in an environment where they are forced to shut the fuck up in class and to see things in a different way. But I could also see the counter argument that that eventually they're going to take over and the institution will no longer have its serve its social purpose. So I really think it's a legitimate concern. And so I share your worry. I wonder though, on the policy dimension, especially when you talk about like Title IX and civil rights legislation, I think it's only a matter of time, personally, before we see that kind of a lawsuit seeking to overturn that gender-based exclusion.
Okay, that was a fair fight. Okay, we've got it. Yeah,
which may or may not be relevant, you know.
Right.
We
have to take another break. Before I let you audience members go, I want to tell you about what's going on at the Pleasure Chest this coming week, because you know they have free sex ed classes, which are fantastic. All you have to do is show up early to get a seat. They're from 8 to 10 p.m., and here's what's coming up. In Chicago, July 12th, Vibrating Your Inner Self with Antoinette Elizabeth. In L.A., July 9th, Intimate Partner Yoga with Miyoko Rifkin. July 12th in L.A., Suck It, Lick It, Love It with Chelsea and Michelle. In New York City, July 9th, Midori presents Hot Squirming, an Erotic Humiliation Play. July 11th, Hot Sex and Passionate Relationships in 10 Steps with Dr. Jess, great presenter. And July 12th, going back to the basics here, Blowjobs and Beyond with Brandon B. Check all that out and more at thepleasurechest.com. Stay with us. Coming up, I am going to take a little example from my own life and throw out a new case study and see what Heath does with it. In this particular situation, does gender matter? We'll find out.
Pride is a time of both celebration and resistance, a time to reflect on how far we've come and how far we still have to go. The Pleasure Chest was birthed in the West Village during the Stonewall era and has spent the past 45 years asserting sexual fulfillment is a fundamental right and creating a space where everyone is welcome and accepted. In honor of Pride Month, Pleasure Chest will be presenting a full lineup of queer-themed workshops and events that are free to the public, including special guest educators like Damon Holtzum, Dr. Liz Powell, and me. You can also visit pleasurechest.com for curated collections of sex toys, such as M for M, Queer Couples, and Strap On, Get Off. Pick up something for a loved one or a little something sexy for yourself. And remember, you get a free massage candle when you use the code Tristan at checkout. B-Vibe is a premium collection of anal sex toys. Their products feature different sizes to accommodate users of all shapes, sizes, and experience levels. B-Vibe's high-end designs are couples-friendly, body-safe, and offer innovation aimed to create an exceptional user experience. You know I've got really high standards when it comes to anal toys, and I am in love with these. Plus, they stand behind each item with an easy-to-understand, hassle-free warranty. Dubbed as the Apple of anal, learn how B-Vibe and its premium anal plugs are engaging couples to discover the amazing pleasures of anal play. Visit bvibe.com and use coupon code Tristan to receive 20% off your purchase.
You're tuned in to Sex Out Loud with your host, Tristan Taramino. We want to hear from you. If you have a question or comment, please send an email to Tristan@puckerup.com. That's Tristan@puckerup.com. Now back to the show.
Welcome back to Sex Out Loud, everyone. We're talking with Heath Fogg Davis. And as I was reading his book this week, I also talked to a friend of mine who loves to go to Korean spas for women. And she loves to go with her girlfriend. And they have been navigating this particular terrain. And I'm interested to see, Heath, if you'll sort of chime in about what you think on the policy level, which is the traditional thing that happens at a Korean spa is you're naked, right? That's just like sort of a given. You could not be naked, but most people are naked.
Okay.
And it's, quote, women's space. And when they call, and so one of these women in this configuration is a trans woman who has a penis and scrotum and but an F on her driver's license. That's okay. An important point. Okay.
Right.
So they call ahead and they ask. When they bring up this notion of trans, it often sort of goes over everyone's head.
Yeah.
And sometimes so there was one place they went where they said the policy is you have to be a woman and we will check your driver's license. And they were like, great, okay, see you later. So they showed up, checked the driver's license, went to the Korean spa. And about an hour into their time there, a manager came and approached them and said, can you please get dressed? And can we go to the office? Can we talk about this? And there had been a complaint. In this case, actually not from another customer, but from a staff member.
Mm-hmm.
And they tried to do a little Trans 101, you know, on the spot. But as they've navigated going to other spas, this continually sort of comes up for them. And no one wants to explicitly, first of all, talk about bodies, right? They really want to talk about identity a lot, but they don't want to talk about bodies.
Right.
And no one seems to know what to do in this particular kind of space.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. This is, I think you're exactly right. I mean, my mind goes to this, this issue about, I mean, we walk around in our society, with our sex markers and just on our visual inspections, and we use like gender designations as a proxy for what our bodies look like and in particular genitalia. So, but we don't typically see each other naked, you know, and if we did more of that, then we would have, as everybody knows, a much, you know, much more diverse understanding of what bodies can look like and what penises and scrotum can look like. And so I guess to kind of, you know, go back to the question about what's the legitimate policy objective in this case, I guess it would have to, you would have to ask about sort of like, what's the purpose of a spa like that? And is gender relevant to that? And in what specific way? So is it like a concern around safety? I would want to ask the staff member that complained what the issue was in particular. Because, yeah, do you have a sense of what
that was? Oh, the penis was the issue for sure.
Yeah,
the penis.
Yeah. And so it's, this is not a case study that I deal with in the book, so I'm just kind of trying to operate on the
fly. Yeah, you're doing it on the fly. Fair enough. Right.
I don't know. What do you think? Can I ask you and your take on it? I mean,
yeah. Well, I thought about it a lot.
Yeah.
I think that these are private businesses, right?
Right.
There's no sort of public spot. I mean, there's public locker rooms at gyms and stuff, but these are like private. So I think the spa needs to have a very specific policy. They need to be explicit about it, and it needs to be at the front desk. So if I walk up to the front desk and it says, hi, let us tell you about our spa. We are all about self-identification in terms of gender, and we believe there are lots of different kinds of bodies, and at our spa, you're going to see lots of different kinds of bodies. Are you cool with that? Cool. Sign in.
Yeah.
And then if I'm someone who would freak the fuck out about that, I'm going to go to another spa.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah.
So I think
as
long as everyone's sort of like on the same page, but I feel like sort of policing people by their bodies is, again, then it's like, then we have like masseuses trying to assess people's gender while they're sitting in a hot tub. I that seems like a recipe for disaster.
Yeah, it does. And it's also, I mean, I would be curious about sort of the legality in the first place, because it goes back to like these bathroom bills, you know, so there are these laws in place around sex segregated bathroom facilities. So presumably the spa has some bathroom facilities that might be connected to whatever their other facilities. But when it comes to other things like that, like, you know, like you have these gyms that are like, they advertise that they're for women, you know, they legally cannot exclude men from joining because they're open to the public, you know, so it's a civil rights issue. So it would be interesting to think about, you know, what, you know, where spas in this particular case sort of fall in that sort of like legal rubric. I suspect that it goes with the territory of bathrooms and lockers, because, you know, and showers, and those are things that are made exceptions in a lot of localities. But it does. I mean, I really like your idea of being specific about the policy and just upfront about it, forcing them to, if we're talking about like naked bodies, then say what's acceptable and what's not acceptable, or, you know, say, you know, this is what we're about, and making it clear so people understand. I think the problem arises when people don't, you know, they just freak out about penises and without any sort of like explanation or context about why mm-hmm. that would be problematic. Right. And I can think of reasons why it could legitimately be problematic. Like giving people kind of like a heads up in the beginning, I think, is important.
Well, I would love to hear from you guys, my audience, about what you think Korean spas should do and how they should how they should address gender. You can call me on my line, 323-SEX-8266, or you can email me, Tristan@puckerup.com. Thank you so much, Heath, for being on the show. I really appreciate it.
Oh, thank you so much. I'm a big fan, and so this has been really, really, really great. Thank you very much.
Heath Fogg Davis is the author of Beyond Trans, Does Gender Matter? Find out more at heathfoggdavis.com. Connect with him on Twitter at Heath Fogg Davis. And now, another little moment brought to us by The Pleasure Chest.
The Pleasure Chest presents Sex Toy Hacks, Queering Your Sex Edition with Victor.
Hi, I'm Victor. I'm the National Buying and Merchandising Manager at The Pleasure Chest. I want to talk to you about Max Powerful Nipple Suckers. These are awesome, just as intended as for creating suction on the nipples, but they are also very easy to queer by using them on your genitals. So you can actually use these to create a really intense suction on your cock or clit, however you want to refer to your genitals. And what it does is that it like pulls a lot of blood to the area, so it creates like an engorged kind of erection. So you can actually, if you're fluid bonded with someone, you could actually penetrate them for a couple of minutes during the duration of the erection, and it also makes it more sensitive. So it's kind of like a traditional pump, but for someone who has different anatomy. And you can find these online at pleasurechest.com or at any of our stores.
Thanks for that tip, Victor. Hey, everyone. Tune in next Friday, 5 p.m. Pacific, 8 p.m. Eastern, when my guests will be Rachel Kramer Bussell, editor of the erotica anthology On Fire, along with contributors reading their work. It's going to be a sexy time. Until then, hit me up on social media. Follow my Twitter feed at Sex Out Loud Radio and at Tristan Taramino. I'm also Tristan Taramino on Instagram, where there's lots of fun pictures. And till next time.
That's a wrap on today's show. Go to voiceamerica.com to listen to this and other episodes on demand or as podcasts. And make sure you come back next Friday night at 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 Pacific, for Sex Out Loud with Tristan Taramino on Voice America Variety.